Okay, so my name is Asa Auerbach. I'm very pleased to be here and spend some time with you. I was asked to give a course for graduate level students on essentially quantum many-body theory. Now, quantum many-body physics is a very broad topic. I will concentrate on a particular discipline that that I think is important, and it's not very well taught in many places because it's kind of a modern way of looking at quantum many-body physics, which is to actually start from quantum magnetism, which is a particular subtopic of interacting spins. From that, to learn how to treat interacting Bose systems, especially. And the most interesting interacting Bose system, of course, is a superfluid. And I saw that the previous lecture already used some equations from superfluidity to give examples on field theory. And in fact, superfluidity, which also is the same topic as superconductivity, is the subject of great experimental and theoretical interest. It also has applications to high energy physics, Higgs phenomena, spontaneous symmetry breaks, and so on. So I think starting from quantum magnetism and leading to superconductivity, we'll be able to gain more intuition of what really superfluidity really means. And especially when you come to discuss dynamics and fluctuations, analogies to quantum spin systems is very useful. So I'm not assuming that you have too much of advanced statistical mechanics or any quantum field theory background or Feynman diagrams or advanced solid state physics. All you need for this course is a good, solid understanding of second quantization, which I understand you've went through, and a little bit of mean field theory, perhaps, on occasion for interacting statistical mechanics, simple interacting statistical mechanics problems, and quantum mechanics, of course, which, since this is a perimeter institute, I assume everybody knows is quantum mechanics. So the first lecture, I'm going to discuss an elementary model called the Hubbard model. I'm not going to solve it, I'm just going to discuss it, and I'm going to do a transformation on it. The purpose is essentially to learn how to start with a model and derive out of it an effective Hamiltonian, a more simplified model that allows you to approach the understanding of what goes on at low temperatures and low energies. It's called renormalization. Now, I know the word renormalization appears a lot in statistical mechanics as part of renormalization group. And there's also renormalization in high energy physics, which has to do with taking care of unphysical cutoffs. This is not the usage of renormalization that I want to talk about. I want to talk about the new usage, which is much more, intuitive and useful, which is how to replace a complicated Hamiltonian with a simpler one. That's all. And that demands some techniques, not very complicated ones, but it's also a conceptual approach that in physics we use a lot, even though we don't define it as such. So, for example, all of our physics is essentially based on the high energy standard model, but when we do condensed matter physics, we don't use the standard model, we use a model of interacting electrons and ions. So there is a path from the standard model to the atomic physics, and from atomic physics through chemistry to the condensed matter physics. And that path is essentially a path of renormalization, a path where we constantly get rid of high energy degrees of freedom that don't interest us and keep collective degrees of freedom that matter for the low energy and low temperature. So when you go from the standard model, you create the you create from the quarks you create the nucleons, from the nucleons you create the atoms, and with the electrons you eventually create molecules and solids. All that is renormalization, because once we renormalize, we don't talk about nucleons anymore. We don't talk even we do talk about the nuclei, and we talk about the electrons. But in condensed matter, as you know, when you get down to the band structure, you already talk about just the electrons that live in the conduction band, and we don't talk about all the core electrons and all the high excitations, because we are renormalizing away the high energy degrees of freedom to get to the lowest one. Now, this process is complicated, and many times we do it ad hoc. We just write down the effective Hamiltonian and say somehow we got from the high energy to the low energy one, but there is actually a procedure that has to be taken, and we use it all the time. Now, once we get to condensed matter physics, we also have essentially an interacting electron model that's too complicated to solve. So we replace it with a tight binding approximation and some minimal interactions, and that is called the Hubbard model. And the Hubbard model is considered a microscopic model for condensed matter. I'm sorry, I'll just get rid of this. So the Hubbard model is a microscopic model, but even the Hubbard model is very difficult to solve. And the first thing we'll do is see how we start with the Hubbard model as the microscopic model, and we normalize it down to a simpler model, which is called the quantum Heisenberg model. And the Heisenberg model will keep renormalizing down until we solve it. And that's essentially a sequence of procedures which we'll go through a little bit of that to show the logic. And the logic is such that eventually, when we end up with a low energy effective Hamiltonian, we're not just pulling it out of the hat. We have some connection to the physics of the system, and we know when it applies and when it doesn't apply. So what essentially this course is going to cover is the first step is going to be taking the Hubbard model and getting out of it at particular fillings, at particular density of electrons, getting the Heisenberg model. Now, in the transformation from the Hubbard to the Heisenberg, we change degrees of freedom. Here we have electrons, spinful electrons. And here we have spin half degrees of freedom. So a lot of simplification is happening when we turn from electrons, which have charge fluctuations and spin fluctuations, to just spin fluctuations. Also, we go from representations, which are fermions, to representations, which are bosons. And representations, which are bosons, usually have a lot of advantages in terms of treating them with all kinds of semi-classical and other approximations. So the second part is to show a very similar transformation. In fact, mathematically, it's nearly going to be the same. So once you understand the first transformation, the second one will be very easy. To start with attractive interactions, between electrons, and end up with a model of essentially hardcore bosons. This transformation, which I'll follow exactly the same procedure here, is the transformation that in the theory of superconductivity is done at weak coupling. Here I'll do it at strong coupling, but it's essentially a way of creating Cooper pairs, creating pairs of electrons out of attractively interacting electrons. That transformation leads to a model that is very close to understanding what a superconductor is and a superfluid is. And that's why it's so useful. So the third topic, once we already have a model that can give us easily superconductivity, is to understand what really is superfluidity. For many people, superfluidity is a mystery. There's some other parameter in there that is quite mysterious. It has to do with an operator that does not conserve number of particles and lives only in the grand canonical ensemble. So the order parameter is a mystery. But once we do these transformations, we'll see that the order parameter here is not so mysterious. And in fact, we can have a very physical intuition of what it is. So for this, I hope by the end of the course, you'll understand what the order parameter of a superfluid is. And then more interesting stuff like vortices and then dynamics. And the last part will be to understand continuum versus lattice effects. This is already quite modern stuff that has not been appreciated till very recently. When you put bosons in the continuum, you have a Gross-Pitayevsky field theory that describes it. When you put it on a lattice, that theory is no longer valid, and one should use different theories. And the correct theories to use when you have a lattice will be closely related to whatever we learn about the Heisenberg model, which is another theory of bosons on lattice. So this is essentially what I'm hope to cover. I'll go slower if I see that you know, there's difficulty in catching up. But I think that by the end of this course, I hope you'll have some tools that you'll be able to understand modern condensed matter physics, which includes effects that we see now in cold atoms on lattices, superconductors with very short coherence length, like the high TC cuprates and the nictides and the fullerenes and all these interesting superconductors that are more like hardcore bosons than the BCS theory. I'm not discussing here any Fermi liquid theory or effects of fermions, not that they're not important or interesting, and I'm not discussing one dimension, which again is a completely interesting topic, separate topic in condensed matter and many-body physics. I mostly will essentially gear towards understanding two and the higher dimension macroscopic phases like superconductivity. I think by that I finish the introduction. Any questions? Feel free to ask questions, you know. That will slow me down and also make life more interesting. Okay, let me. So. See, I'm using the scroll routine here. Okay. So so just to give you an introduction to the Hubbard model, in case you haven't seen it, microscopic Hamiltonian of electrons in solids could be written as a quantum field theory. Let's say D equal to 3, where I have some second quantized field and some single particle Hamiltonian, let's say no spin orbit coupling, so S is a good quantum number here, and I have here a P minus EA squared divided by 2 mass of the electron plus some potential minus some chemical potential. And then there's a interaction term, which is some potential Vx minus x prime, psi dagger, psi, psi, s, s prime, s, x, x prime, x prime, x. This form here is formal. It represents essentially all the electron-electron and electron-ion, if this is coming from the ions which are not moving, interactions. In condensed matter physics, usually people tend to do some kind of an approximation on the interaction term, Hartree-Fock, turn it into a two-fermion term, and once it's a two-fermion term, it lumps into this ion potential as a correction coming from the other electrons, and eventually just have a bilinear form, which is a single particle Hamiltonian, right? If you have two creation, one creation, one annihilation operator, you have a bilinear second quantized Hamiltonian. You just have to diagonalize this form. This form is non-diagonal because P is not diagonal in X space. You diagonalize this and you replace it with a band structure, which is very simply some kind of a dispersion times C dagger K CK. That's what you've seen before in condensed matter physics courses. All the physics that goes into essentially writing this down is assuming that the interactions are essentially unimportant in the sense that they do not give us any big change from having an effective free electron gas with a single particle dispersion. So this guy can be diagonalized as sum over k alpha s epsilon k alpha cks cks, and epsilon k are all these bands that people write down, spaghettis we call them, that have some index alpha, momentum k in three dimensions, they have a Brillouin zone, and that essentially describes condensed matter band theory fully. There's nothing else in there. But, of course, these terms are not small. These Coulomb interactions cause a lot of headaches, and one way of avoiding throwing away the Coulomb interactions and treating the system as non-interacting is to renormalize this Hamiltonian into a theory that lives in a single band. So in a sense, I take these high energy electrons out of this band structure, these alphas that are far from the Fermi surface. I have the Fermi surface here, and I eliminate these guys. I have an effective Hamiltonian that lives in one band, but these interactions change. They're already interactions between particles or quasi-particles in the same band, and that is the Hubbard model. So I'm not showing you the transition between the microscopic interacting electron model and the Hubbard model. That transition is actually not very well known, how to do that transition. There's enormous amount of computational efforts that people do in order to try to derive the parameters of the Hubbard model. I have little faith in their accuracy or their correctness. The eventual outcome of such a Hamiltonian is the Hubbard model, which is essentially written in a one-year basis on the lattice. Again, I'm assuming no spin-orbit coupling. So there's a hopping term. This is a tight binding model you've seen before, a way of representing epsilon k in real space between one-year states. These are called hopping integrals. And then there's a interactions between densities of electrons at different 1U orbitals. Of course, if I took this full Hamiltonian and wrote its matrix elements in 1U basis, I will get more terms, which are more complicated, like C dagger C on, and C dagger C times NJ. In other words, there'll be other terms which I'm throwing away, neglecting, and keeping only these terms is already an approximation. But as I said, the renormalization procedure should give us a way of calculating T and U. And what we do in the Hubbard model is even make this much simpler, make T essentially just nearest neighbor, make U just on site, and that will give us the usual, what's called one-band Hubbard model. So I'll write it in the form that looks like IJ, CI, CJ, SS, plus CJ, CI, SS. This is the kinetic term. And then there is sum over I, half U, NI squared, which is the on-site repulsion term. So, as I said, this is an oversimplified model of interacting electrons. The band structure here is assumed to be described by a single hopping parameter of nearest neighbor. That will mean that epsilon k is just a sum of cosines. And you know, it's not describing the exact band structure, but presumably close to the Fermi surface. If we get the right velocities there, we can approximate the band structure. This is not even a symmetric one. So let's say the band structure was something like this. And I'm approximating it with a nice cosine. So these are not horrible approximations to replace the band structure with a tight binding nearest neighbor model. And all the interactions in terms of U, because that's the strongest part of the Coulomb interaction, of course, is when X is close to X prime, which is when the two electrons sit on the same orbital. And again, I'm writing the Hamiltonian down ad hoc now, not deriving it, just to introduce it to you and tell you that there is a connection to the microscopics. And this allows us to start studying the many-body effects much better than before. Yeah? Uij is essentially the matrix element of this interaction. This is an operator called V between phi I, phi j, phi I, phi j, where phi I, phi j are 1U orbitals related to the band structure that we keep. Okay, so 1U orbitals are things you know about. Could you explain to them 1U orbitals in the, I don't want to get into that now, but 1U orbitals is a Fourier transform of the Bloch wave functions back to the lattice. They are orthogonal bases that is described by the index of the lattice point. The wave functions themselves are localized around the lattice point, but they're orthogonalized. Okay, they're like atomic orbitals, to be very rough. Of course, it depends on the type of band structure. If I have a band structure which is very atomic-like, made out of atomic orbitals with weak tunneling between them, the 1U orbitals will be essentially the atomic orbitals. If there's a lot of overlap between the states, the 1U orbitals have a long tail in the other sites. So I'll just draw, if these are the lattice points, this is a 1U orbital that is associated with the site I. And 1U orbital with site J will be exactly the same. It has these wiggles in order to be orthogonal to the first guy. And that's, is that good enough to explanation so far? What? What do you call it? Okay. Yeah. Yes. Ah, okay. Okay, fine. No. Okay, we don't need to know 1D orbitals and how to diagonalize them and how to write everything. I just want to give an impression of how to go to this model. And if you don't understand it completely, that's okay. Nobody understands it completely, okay? It's a bit of a black magic, but many times chemistry does these things. Essentially, you write down a model that is oversimplified in some ways, but includes the many-body interactions explicitly, and we didn't throw them away. We didn't replace U Ni squared with some chemical potential times N, which is what Hartree-Fock theory does. We're keeping this degree of freedom. Now, why is that important? Because soon we'll learn how a lot of physics come out from this U, especially when U is large. Okay, so that's the Hubbard model. And the first thing we want to look at the Hubbard model before we even discuss all its possibilities is just solve the two-site Hubbard model. Ah, sorry. Ni, I said, was density. Okay. Yeah, I should. Okay. So. Okay, now I'll do everything properly. I'll solve with all the definitions the two-site Hubbard model. And then all the operators will be clear. Two sites. One, two. There's a hopping integral between them, minus t. So my Hamiltonian is minus t c1s c2s plus c2s c1s, sum over s. This is site one, site two. This describes, in a second quantized way, just a single particle with a tunneling matrix element t between two points. Of course, if you just solve this, you'll get the symmetric and anti-symmetric states. And that will be your band structure for two sites. Symmetric state is plus plus, semi-symmetric plus minus, and that's solving this model. And now, on top of that, I have U, which I write as a U over 2. Sum over I, and then I have here a Ni squared. But what is Ni? Ni is sum over S, C dagger IS, CIS. So if you want it, sum over S, Ni up plus Ni down. Ni squared is, sorry, don't need a sum over S here, is Ni up squared plus Ni down squared plus 2Ni up Ni down. Now, Ni up squared, this is a density of a single fermion at a single site. Ni up squared has to be equal to Ni up. And Ni down squared is again equal to Ni down, right? You just write C up, C up, C up, C up. And you see that this is equal to C up, C up. Right? Because of the commutation here. If I commute this, I get 1. And then C dagger up is 0. So that's the term. So anyways, this is a simple way of writing it. So I have here Ni, which is the sum of Ni up plus Ni down, plus 2 times Ni up, Ni down. So the Hubbard model many times is not written as Ni squared, but you'll see it written in terms of Ni plus Ni up, Ni down. Now this guy is a single particle operator. It's just C dagger C. So you could lump that into the chemical potential term. So if I had a chemical potential term, the chemical potential term would be minus mu sum over I and I, this guy could just be changing mu to mu prime, right? So if I want to write this in another form that is usually used. It's C1S, C2S, plus C2S, C1S, plus U, the factor of 2 goes away from this factor of 2, sum over I, Ni up, Ni down, minus mu prime, sum over I, Ni, where mu prime includes U over 2. So that's the Hubbard model for two sites, and I want to solve it now in two limiting cases. Yeah. Sorry, yes. Just shout out there.
How does the sum of Ni up and Ni down equal Ni? Would you mind clarifying what you mean by that?
This is equal to Ni up, right? Because it's a property of fermions that density operators are essentially a projector, so its square is equal to itself. And that's why I replaced this with Ni. And now. Ah, that's the definition here.
Okay. It's like saying
that total density.
The number of electrons on the site is equal to the number of up electrons plus the number of down electrons. So those are the only two possibilities. That's why
I'm not. Yeah, when I drop the index of the spin, it's the total density of site I. Okay, so let me solve this very simple Hamiltonian. Can't be difficult because number of states here is not very large. But I want to really solve it. And I'll do, first of all, I'll solve it ignoring U. And I'll solve it, first of all, just this part. So this is called T, the kinetic energy. So if I solve the kinetic energy, start using the other boards. Before I want to look at symmetries, before I solve it. That's always a good idea. You look at Hamiltonian and say, what does it commute with? Well, first of all, H commutes with a total number, which is N1 plus N2. Okay. How do I do it? First of all, these terms, they're written in terms of N, N1 and N2. N1 and N2 commute with each other because they're defined with operators that live on different sites, commute, anti-commute. So therefore, the interaction part, U, commutes with N1 plus N2. The kinetic energy, we just have to calculate the commutation relation. And if I do that, T commutes N1 plus N2. I'll do it, even though this is a very simple exercise. So I have sum over S, and then I have C1S, C2S, but that's commuting, okay, have to do it a bit slower. So let's take C1S, C2S, and commute it with N1. So N1 commuted with C dagger, right, with this will give us, if it was the other direction, it would be plus, this is minus, minus C1S, C2S. But let's take this operator and commute it with N2. Then I have a plus. It's exactly the same operator. So if I sum N1 and N2, this hopping matrix element will essentially this hopping matrix element will give us 0. In other words, we didn't have to do the calculation. We just have to look at the physical meaning of this creation and annihilation operators. What this guy does, it takes away electron from 2, but puts it in 1. So the total doesn't change. Okay? That's the meaning of this commutation I calculated. Okay? So hopping matrix elements don't change the total density. They just move things around. And since the kinetic energy and the potential energy both don't change the density, it commutes with density. But now the total number n, which is n1 plus n2, is one conserved quantity. I can label all the eigenstates with this conserved quantity. The other conserved quantity will be spin. So for spin, I have to define total spin. S total is S of spin 1 plus S of spin 2. So I'm adding angular momentum to create another angular momentum. And now the question is, does the total spin commute with Hamiltonian? So for that, I need to calculate commutation relation with three operators, S total Z, which is written as a half N I up minus N I down, sum over I. So let me write explicitly 1 and 2. So this is SZ1, and this is N2 up minus N2 down. This is SZ1, SZ2, and I'm calculating SZ total. So this operator here commutes with Hamiltonian. Why? Because, first of all these operators are functions of Ni up and Ni down, as you can see, and they commute with Ni up and Ni down for both 1 and 2. The hopping matrix element will commute with Sz because it conserves separately, because of the hopping, conserves S. Now, if I take a spin of up from here, I have to put back a spin of up here. That's a property of the fact that the hopping has the same S on 1 and 2. So again, the same way I showed the density doesn't change, the density of up doesn't change, and the density of down doesn't change. These are two quantities conserved separately. And since Sz is just the difference of these two quantities, then H commutes with Sz total. OK, that means we have one quantum number already, the total magnetization Sz. But it commutes with more than that. It commutes also with Sx total and Sy total. So what is, so I can define S plus total as Sx plus I Sy total. I'm sorry that I flip all the time superscripts and subscripts. It's a bad habit of mine, but OK. So S plus total is a raising operator. And it could be written in terms of, and you'll have some exercises about that, so you'll see how it works. But S total is essentially C dagger up, C down on site 1, plus C dagger up on site 2, C 2 dagger. This is a raising operator. It takes a spin down and turns it into spin up in site 2, or it takes a spin down and raises it to spin up in site 1. That raises the total spin. This operator, you can also see by direct evaluation, commutes with the density operators, and it also commutes with the hopping matrix elements, because it's a total raising operator. So I'm just stating and asking you to verify that I'm correct at home, that this guy also commutes with Hamiltonian. And not only the raising operator, but the lowering one, because that's just the Hermitian conjugate of this commutator. So therefore, H commutes with all alpha of the total spin. Yes, questions?
You said that when you wrote S dagger total in terms of sum of Z's, the sum of products, is that it either change the changes spin down to spin up on site two, or changes spin down to spin up on site one?
Yes. And that's why total magnetization will go up by one, right?
So I'm thinking about the algebra. I see a plus sign. Why should that, I interpret that as an or here? Is it, why not? Yeah, so why would
it's total. Total. Total means I take this guy and add the spin one to the spin two. So I add this is S plus of side one. This is S plus of side two.
Right, so
and in angular momentum, I just add the operators to get the total.
It just looks to me like that would change a spin down to a spin up on side two and change a spin down to a spin up on side two.
No, that will happen if I took a product. If I take a wave function here, let's say if I take a wave function that looks like up on one, down on two, okay? Well, this guy will decrease the down, it will annihilate this wave function. Because this guy applying to this will give zero. However, this guy will, this will not annihilate. This will give me the vacuum and it will create a spin up on two. So the total, this guy will give us this guy. This guy will annihilate, so this guy won't act. So a particular state here is modified by this operator, and another kind of state will be modified by this operator, but overall the effect of this sum will be to take a certain magnetization, which here happens to be zero, and turn it into one, right? Because you have a half minus a half is zero, and half plus a half is one. So I'm changing the total magnetization from zero to one, applying S plus total. Okay, I know for people who haven't worked with second quantized operators, or especially in condensed matter, a lot of these algebras look opaque on the board, but this is why exercises are very important. When you play with operators and you play with commutations and states, all the algebra in Fock space becomes much more transparent. But to see it first time on the board is not easy, I know. Okay. This is alpha equal x, y, z, or plus minus z, okay? Depending on how you want to define the angular momentum operators. So H commutes with S total. Now if, from the theories of angular momentum, S total has eigenvalues, S total squared. What eigenvalues can S total squared have? Well, it's S plus one. And S can have, for two electrons of spin a half, can have either zero or one. This is called a singlet. And these are three states called the triplet. So singlets, there'll be several singlets in this model. There'll be one kind of triplet. Triplet actually will be a state given by both spins up on one and two, both spins down on one and two, and a third state with magnetization zero, which is a symmetric combination of up and down. These are the triplets. The triplets have also SZ total running from minus one, or this is actually plus one, minus one, and zero. That's the three allowed Z angular momentum for triplets. Singlet, of course, has zero Z angular momentum. So these are the kind of states we expect. And now we'll write down the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, both for the non-interacting and for the interacting, using those quantum numbers and the N quantum numbers. So we work in a canonical formulation where we fix N and look at the states. And by looking at the spectrum, a lot of physics could be learned, and I think that's the main message that we'll have today. Let's see. So, let us diagonalize. Oh. Let us diagonalize the non-interacting. Non-interacting non-interacting, as I said, has two single particle states. Single particle states are the ones you get by taking the quadratic form here, which happens to be just a matrix 2 by 2 with off-diagonal terms between 1 and 2, and diagonalizing it. And of course, you get the symmetric and antisymmetric states. So you'll get essentially two operators, C plus, which is 1 over square root of 2 of C1, and it has the label S, plus C2, label S. So notice I'm not diagonalizing states, I'm diagonalizing operators. That happens to be a more convenient way of writing things. I'm just finding a unitary transformation between C1S, C2S, and new operators called C plus and C minus, which is C1S minus C2S. This unitary transformation is canonical because unitary transformations on single particle fermion operators are canonical. They preserve the commutation rules. So C dagger C of this basis, it gives you delta functions exactly like the commutations, the anti-commutations of fermions. So let me write it. C alpha S dagger C alpha prime S prime anti-commutation is delta alpha alpha prime delta S S prime. That's canonical. You can check that if you assume canonical commutation relations here. And I can write down now the Hamiltonian in a diagonal form. H is equal to minus T sum, minus T C plus S C plus S plus T C minus S C minus S. If you want to write the band structure of this model, it has one energy at minus T and another energy at plus T. That's the state plus plus, and that's the state plus minus in real space. This is the state I call plus, and this is the state I call antisymmetric state. Now, how do I put many electrons in this problem? Very simple, as you do band structure theory. If you have one electron, you put it down here to get the ground state, or you can put it in up or down spin, and an excited state will be here, up or down spin. If you have two electrons, you can distribute them both on the bottom, both on the top, one in the bottom, one in the top, and you get six states out of that. So let us just study the two-electron problem, n equal to 2. As I said, n is a good quantum number. I can fix it to be two electrons, and I'll just put it in this Hamiltonian, and I look at the different states I get. So this is my many-body spectrum, not to be confused with a single particle spectrum. Okay, single particle spectrum is a tool to get out of it many-body spectrum. The many-body spectrum is actually given by, you know, putting here ones and zeros. So if you put here two spins, this is actually a sum of the spins, up and down. If I make C minus zero for both up and down spins and C plus plus for both spins, I get an energy of minus 2t, because it's 2 times minus t. I can usually you write it in this form. Now, this form is very specific to non-interacting electrons, right? This is putting two electrons in orbitals that are antisymmetric. That's a kind of the way you do in band theory. But here it's okay. I have no interactions. I put two electrons up and down in this, and I get energy minus 2t. And I get a singlet state. Now, this singlet state is putting two electrons in a symmetric combination. I can write it in real space just for how does it look in real space. In real space means write down the state in terms of 1 and 2. And then it looks like the following. Looks like up on 1, down on 2, minus down on 1, up on 2, plus 2 electrons on 1, 0 on 2, plus 0 on 1, 2 electrons on 2. And there's a minus. Okay, and I have to normalize this, of course. There's 4 states, so it's square root of 4. Okay. This is a singlet. Now, why is it a singlet? If you apply to it S plus or S minus total or SZ, you get 0. It vanishes. That's a singlet. The singlets you've seen maybe previously in the literature include just what two spin and a half form a singlet. But here there's a possibility of two of the electrons sitting on the same side. There's no punishment in terms of U for putting two electrons. So that also contributes to the singlet. Now let's talk about the excitations. Well, the excitations will have essentially at energy zero the states with triplets, up, up, down, down, and up, down, plus down, up, by the square root of 2. That's S equal 1. How do you get that? Well, you get that by essentially taking an electron from the single particle state here, putting one electron here, and another electron, let's say with the up spin, it's possible to pull up up spin in a different orbital, and this guy will give me a triplet. Why? It has SZ equal to 1, and if you look at its wave function, it's exactly this one. If you take this guy down and this guy down, you'll get this state. The third state is a bit more complicated, but you also get the third state by this excitation. And this excitation has zero energy because it's minus T plus T. So that's triplets. However, there's another state here. There's another singlet here. And that singlet is written in terms of up, down, 0, plus 0, up, down, divided by square root of 2. That's a singlet that will be given, again, from down here, up here, orthonormalized to the triplet here. I'm telling you the result of a little bit of calculations, but it's very simple to get because these are non-interacting electrons, and I'm only writing the wave functions that I get from this picture in terms of real space. So 3 triplets, 1 singlet, all degenerate at 0. And then I have here at plus 2t another singlet, which is given by this guy minus this guy. So it'll be up, down, minus down, up, minus up, down, 0, minus 0, up, down. Divided by 2. That's S equals 0. So just to summarize it in a cleaner way, here I have a singlet. Here I have, at 0 energy, this is minus 2t, I have 3 triplets and a singlet. And here I have another singlet. This singlet is orthogonal to this one. This one is also orthogonal. And the 3 triplets are here. Okay, why do I do all this work? The ground state is a singlet. We know, for instance, in a band structure, when you fill up all the bands with equal number of spin up and spin down, even if there's 10 to the 23 electrons, because of the equality of the number of spin up and spin down, the ground state is a singlet. So even here you get that it's like a Fermi liquid ground state. I want to point out that there are no interactions here. All the energy scales have to do with the hopping. This degeneracy shows the fact that the excitations of the system are really not triplets and singlets. They are spin and a half objects. Why? Because if I have a singlet degenerate with a triplet, then if I do a superposition of them, it looks like spin up, spin down, and spin down, spin up with the same energies. I could take a superposition which is plus or minus, and that really is the property of two independent spin-ons, they're called. It's like, so when I have a degeneracy of a singlet with three triplets, it's a sign of three spin-a-halves. Now, in a Fermi liquid, in gas, in a metal, we know the excitations are essentially electrons carrying spin-a-half. Of course, the quantum numbers are always integer, but you can think of the quasi-particles of a metal as spin-a-half electrons moving around freely, not bound to other spin-a-halves, or not bound to triplets. That's this degeneracy that we have here. So there's a fourfold degeneracy in the non-interacting case. Once we put interactions, this degeneracy is lifted. And then we have another singlet, which is high up. So the next thing to do is to write down the solution. What happens when you put U into the problem? When you put U into the problem, the spectrum will change and physics will change. And that's what we're interested in. How does interactions give us a new physics? So any questions so far? Okay, yes. Free spin halves? So imagine I had two wells with spin halves in them. No coupling. I'll get four degenerate states, right? Out of those four degenerate states, I can write three triplets, one singlet. So this is the analogy. I have four degenerate states represented essentially by two free spin halves. They don't want to form any kind of a bound triplet or singlet because of this degeneracy. It's exactly like taking two faraway spins, spin S and S prime, and I have four degenerate states. Because I can make any superpositions out of a degenerate manifold. Okay? So that's the lesson to learn. And now we look at the effects of interactions, and then you can see some interesting changes. Now, fortunately, the actual calculation will be done by Dennis in his tutorial. He very gracefully agreed to do the hard work for me. I'll just show the result and analyze it. It's not such a difficult problem. It's essentially diagonalizing not more than 2 by 2 matrices, but you have to write it in the right basis and diagonalize it. So one thing that helps is to work in the total spin basis of singlets and triplets. So the only thing I'll mention is that the triplet is the simplest one to calculate, because the triplets, both for non-interacting and for interacting, just have zero energy in this model for half filling. So now we take U larger than zero, N equal to 2, and we use a local basis, 1, 2, S, S prime. These are the local basis. Yes? I'm using the site 1, site 2, spin S prime, as a basis. It's not the eigenstate. It's just the basis of the many-body model. And then there's 2 on site 1 and 0. And then there is, so okay, so this is 1 many-body state. This is 4 many-body states. This is 1, and this is 1. So you have 6 many-body states. And you diagonalize the Hamiltonian in a space of 6 by 6. But you could use the fact that it's split into singlets and triplets. If you look at the triplets, the triplets are the ones where the two spins cannot be on the same side, so they don't belong to these two. They're inside here. Out of the four, there are 3 out of the four, and they're the triplets. The triplet energy is easily evaluated because the effect of U is zero. Why? Because in the triplet basis, there are no doubly occupied sites, and U only gets a non-zero value if there's ni up times ni down. It means both needs up and down spin. There's only up without down, U vanishes. So U gives you no contribution on the triplets. It's well known this is an effect that is known in atomic physics, that local interactions in triplets are zero because spins cannot occupy the same space with the same spin. And triplets have the same spin. So the energy is zero, and also the kinetic energy does not couple the triplets to any other state. So how do I see that? T of a triplet. First of all, T conserves spin, so it can't couple me to anything else. But let's say if I wanted to couple a triplet to any other state, I'll essentially need to hop electrons. But this triplet has two electrons sitting like that. How can I hop them? If I try to hop this guy to here, I get zero. Two spins in the same direction, not allowed by Pauli principle. Similar here. So any action of T on the triplet is zero. So therefore, the triplets are completely disconnected at zero energy, and their energy is zero. So energy of triplet is zero. So we threw away three states out of the six. Now we're left with three singlets to diagonalize. And as I said, I won't do that. I'll just show you the result. The result is the following. Here is the triplets. One, two, three. This is the triplet. Up, up, down, down, up, down, minus down, plus down, up. Square root of two. Now there's three singlets. One singlet has the form up, down, minus down, up, plus some alpha, which is small, times the other contribution that we had before. And it's not normalized here. So notice what happened. This energy here, difference, actually is minus T minus 4 T squared over U. So let me take large U over T. That's the strong interacting limit. This guy is actually quite close to zero. It's not minus 2T like we had before. It's minus 4T squared over U, but U is a large number, so it could be much closer to zero than before. This, on the other hand, could be huge. This is of order U. There are two singlets here. One of them is the symmetric combination. Sorry. Plus. And the other guy, and the small corrections of order alpha. And alpha, as you can guess, is of order T over U. Or T over U, much less than 1. So this guy plus order alpha, this is alpha, it's a small parameter, and there's another guy which is minus. So let's analyze what this shows. In the strong interacting U limit, the ground state is still a singlet like before. One could say the ground state didn't feel too much the effect of the strong interaction because it was a singlet before and a singlet later. The only difference is in this singlet, the weight of double occupation is very small. That singlet, the weight of double occupation was the same as the weight of single occupation. Of course, it should be reduced because U penalizes the energy, increases the energy of double occupation. So it has a small contribution of double occupation, but essentially is a singlet. Then the triplets didn't move. They didn't care about U at all. And then you get a huge gap, which is size U, which is called Mott-Hubbard gap. for charge fluctuations, because these are the only states of appreciable weight that have double occupation. So what's the most important thing that happened? The most important thing is the elimination of this degeneracy of spin 0 and spin 1, pushing the spin 0 to high energy, leaving you essentially with a triplet here and a singlet here. So for n equal to 2, the spectrum at low energies essentially is described by singly occupied sites, which have both spin up, spin down, and that's what we call a spin problem. There's no charge fluctuations in the low energy sector. So if I only concentrated on these states and write down a Hamiltonian that describes these states, I will use a much simpler Hamiltonian than the Hubbard model. I'll use the Heisenberg model. And I'll show you that, and that will be the lesson for today. That low energy spectrum of strongly interacting Hubbard model can be renormalized by eliminating high energy states to effective spin model of SU2 symmetry called the Heisenberg model. Okay? So how do I describe a Heisenberg model from these three states? That's very simple. Okay, so let me scroll. Yes. Well, I showed you this spectrum for large U. Large U means small alpha. The small parameter is T over U. So you're asking what happens if I had small U, not large U. This guy? Yeah, there it was 1. There it was 1, the coefficient. And now alpha is much smaller than 1. This is small. So the double occupation part of the singlet becomes very small. The relative. Oh, I'm talking about the relative coefficient. The relative coefficient of this term and this term is 1. And there it's alpha. There it's not normalized. That's what confused you? I didn't normalize this. So here I have to normalize it. If I want to normalize it, square root of 2 plus 2 alpha squared. That helps. Okay, yeah. So let me write the Heisenberg model. So Heisenberg model for two sites is equal to essentially some J, sum over S1, dot S2, written in this form. So I can write this as J S total squared minus S1 squared minus S2 squared, all that divided by 2, right? Because S total is just S1 plus S2. So all I did is rewrite S1 dot S2 as S total squared minus S1 squared S2. Now S1 squared and S2 on the lower subspace are the spin a half, because on the lower subspace, every electron is exactly up to alpha. Okay, forget about the alpha, set alpha equal to 0. Then S1 and S2 are essentially exactly minus 3/4 each. So I have here S total squared minus 3/4 times 2 minus 3/4, half, and there's a J. So S total, we know the effective Hamiltonian should describe a singlet here and then a triplet here. The spacing was minus 4 T squared over U. That's something that I gave it to you without showing you, but that comes from the calculation of the eigenvalues. So all I need to do here is say, what is the splitting between 0 and 1? So this guy will have two energies. If I set S total equal to 0, this will be minus 3/4 J. If I set S total equal to 1, I get a half minus 3/4. Sorry, I'll get 1 times 1 plus 1. I get 2. Divide by 2, it's 1 minus 3/4. I'll get plus 1/4 J. So the distance between minus 3/4 J and 1/4 J is exactly J. So that's the distance here. So up to a constant, my effective Hamiltonian, my Hubbard, for n equal to 2, becomes approximately the same as J S dot S, where J is given from the microscopic parameters minus 4 T squared over U, and it has a name, super exchange. That was invented for a more complicated model by Anderson in the 50s, and it's antiferromagnetic, its sign is positive, the singlet is lower than the triplet, that's a sign of antiferromagnetic J, and it's a quantum spin model of spin a half, Si is equal to half. Okay, so you see how we get from the two-site Hubbard model, a two-site Heisenberg model, by just looking at the low energy spectrum. So what's missing in this model are excitations of energy larger than U, which involve charge excitations. Also, the ground state that we will use for this guy is purely spin. It doesn't have these alphas, so it's setting alpha equal to 0. So this renormalization, which we did today, which was essentially done by fitting the low energy spectrum with another model, pulled it out of the hat, doesn't matter where I took it from, but it fits the spectrum. Once you do that, that model that fits the spectrum, gives you all the right quantum numbers and the energy spacings and the degeneracies, then you replace the original model with an effective Hamiltonian, which is much better than the original one because it's simpler, has fewer degrees of freedom, and there's millions of approximations I could use on this one, which I couldn't use on the original one. Okay? So what I did here was for the two sites. In the next lecture, I'll do it for n sites using a more sophisticated renormalization scheme called Brillouin-Wigner renormalization scheme. And that's essentially setting up for how to do these things in more general. We'll do it just for the Hubbard to Heisenberg at half filling. Why is it called half filling? Because I have two sites and I put two electrons, but I'm allowed to put on two sites four electrons. So two electrons on two sites is half filling. That's why it's called or Ni is equal to half to one. Number of electrons per site is 1. That's a very special filling that you can reduce the Hubbard model to a spin model. If we went away from half filling, if we put more electrons, it wouldn't be any more a spin model because then I wouldn't be able to eliminate the charge fluctuations even if I take U to infinity because there's holes in the problem. And you think of a system where you have spins on part of the sites and holes in another. That's a much more complicated problem. This is the problem that people are thinking about in the context of high-temperature superconductivity, the doped Hubbard model away from half-filling. But we won't go there. We don't need to. We'll just discuss the pure half-filling case. I think it's about time to let you go, no? What do you think? Okay, thank you. So.